So has everybody got everything that they need?
What do we need?
Well, I've got a cup of tea. Uh-huh. You've just had a kebab. Graham's got his boots on, and Ben, I don't know.
I finished my coffee.
Ben's finished his coffee.
I drank it while I was waiting.
Well, that means that we're about ready to start the podcast then, which is Series 3, Episode 4. I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Ben Everard.
I'm Graham Morrison.
And alphabetically, I'm Mike Saunders.
And that means it must be time for Linux Voice, which is a podcast that we do. We also make a magazine. But I'll come back to that in a bit. Still to come, we have news. There's a halfway reminder, finds of the fortnight, and some neurons, and there's even a voice of the masses. If you like the sound of that, you can subscribe to a paper-based version of this podcast, which is a magazine that we do, which is called Linux Voice. Oh dear, I'm sorry. Yes, and that's at shop.linuxvoice.com. If you like the idea of that, but don't want to use trees, you can get an electronically based magazine. Mike?
Yes, and also it's worth pointing out that we are doing our profit donating scheme at the moment. So anybody who's got issue 13 of the magazine, which is on sale on our shop individually, can take part in the profit donating scheme. Or if, like you say, you're not a fan of the dead tree material, then you can get a digital subscription, which includes access to all back issues, all digital back issues, so you can take part in the profit donating scheme then as well.
Right. Is there any news? Has anything new happened in the last 2 weeks?
News? Yes, actually a lot's happened in the Linux world in the last few weeks. more than in most fortnights.
That's because it's been 3 weeks.
It's been 3 weeks. So first off, big news really. The Software Freedom Conservancy and Christopher Helwig have launched a lawsuit against VMware for alleged breaches of the GPL. This centres around, VMware, if you don't know, it's a virtualization platform. So it has its own sort of little operating system, which it calls, hang on.
ESXi.
That's the one, ESXi. And on top of that, you can obviously run virtual machines. Because this is a relatively obscure operating system, not many drivers are written for it. So it includes a whole chunk of the Linux kernel, which they call VMK Linux. VMK Linux, which is pretty much a stripped down version of the Linux kernel. So it can load drivers, and that can talk with the ESXi kernel, which is called VM kernel. Basically, the lawsuit centers on the fact or the question of whether or not VMK Linux and VM kernel are separate pieces of software that just happen to run together, like in the same way that you can run proprietary software on top of Linux without the proprietary software having to be under the GPL, or whether in fact they're the same bit of software that runs together. And the GPL, especially version 2 of the GPL, isn't that explicit about where how to draw this boundary. And it's never been tested in court. So it's not clear, to me at least, which way the court's going to go on this. It's not that cut and dried a case.
So who is Christoph Helwig?
He's a Linux kernel developer. He's one of the top 20 contributors to the kernel. And he personally owns the copyright to a large chunk of the, well, for all the code he's written, as all kernel contributors do. So it's him that, or any kernel contributor who had their code included in this VMware product could sue. He's personally choosing to do it, and the Software Freedom Conservancy are bankrolling him in this lawsuit.
This is what the Software Freedom Conservancy does, isn't it? And they've famously gone after people using BusyBox.
Yeah, and actually VMware's one of those people. There's been a long history. This goes back years and years. And for the most part, VMware have complied. They've changed their code, or they've released code. However, they've said at this point, they don't think it's in breach.
And it's quite unusual because, I mean, VMware are quite an open source Linux friendly corporation. I mean, they wouldn't really exist as they do without Linux and without using the open source software they do. And I think there's, rather than like a purely antagonistic kind of, this is a violation of the GPL, maybe there is a legitimate need to see something like this tried in court.
And there is, the GPL has been around for a long, long time. And, you know, as you say, people like the SFC have gone after people, but it's the legal background, the actual basis of it is very untested. I think it's a good thing for the GPL that it is going through court, whichever way it goes, that people should understand what the actual legal consequences are. And without it ever being tested, that's how do you know?
And VMware does understand the consequences. I think it does understand its obligations. But it sounds from reading about what it's been going on for 3 years, where apparently VMware started off being completely on side and wanting to help and releasing their source code before like a freeze in relations and the Software Freedom Conservancy in the end having to expend a great deal of effort showing that they believe the code is being used.
Yeah, and I think to a certain extent that depends on how core the code is. A lot of the code that they have released and changed has been sort of quite peripheral to their main product, whereas the ESXi it's really central. If that gets open source, then their proprietary software is fairly little.
Yeah.
So I think they're seeing it from a commercial point of view that at this point it's worth the risk rather than...
Yeah. It's a bit... Yeah, I mean, I haven't got that much sympathy for them because I don't see what the problem would be in open sourcing it anyway or it being open source. But, you know, if they want to pick this battle...
Yeah, I mean it's a fairly expensive product, VMware, and they charge. I mean, they make a lot of money from this, and if it was open sourced, I don't know. Maybe it would.
Yeah,
maybe it would be good for them. Maybe it wouldn't.
It's the age long argument of giving it away reduces your ability to make money from it. Which, yeah, they probably have to change their business as a result.
Yeah.
Excellent explanation. I must say that you putting all those pieces of VMware in context is the first time I've really seen it and understood all of those words.
I still keep forgetting which around the S and the X go. I have to keep glancing over. Okay, next up on our news list, more corporations doing bad things, actually. Lenovo. This is actually not Linux related at all, but I threw it in.
Oh, yeah, this was horrendous.
Yeah, Lenovo has been putting basically man in the middle, a root certificate for SSL. So basically, they've got a piece of software which they call Superfish, which does a man in the middle, performs a man in the middle attack on any secure internet or any secure web traffic. So when you type in, I don't know, https://google.com, you think that communication just goes between you and Google and no one can spy on it. But what actually happens in this case is there's a piece of software running in the background on the Lenovo Windows computers that intercepts the SSL traffic, creates a sort of fake certificate for Google, so it can decrypt it, then it re-encrypts it and sends it to Google, so it intercepts all secure web traffic on computers where it's installed.
Isn't this technically illegal?
Well, it really depends on how good your lawyers are.
On your government.
Yeah.
Setting a precedent.
It would certainly be the case if I went to your computer and installed this without telling you, it would be illegal. That is without a question. Mm. But that's because I can't afford the same lawyers that Lenovo can.
And maybe when you turn on your Lenovo laptop for the first time, there's a giant end-user license agreement, and buried in the 500,000 words is a mention of Superfish. And therefore, everybody's agreed to it one way or the other.
I mean, that's... Long licensing agreements aren't usually legally enforceable. Mm. Certainly in the UK, there's a sort of a legal principle that says if a reasonable user couldn't be expected to read it, it's not legally binding. That may not be the case in all legal jurisdictions. So these 1,000-word, War and Peace licensing agreements aren't usually enforceable, but that's provided anyone can be bothered to actually challenge them.
Maybe VMware can claim that the GPL is too long for them to read and that's why they violated it.
Possibly.
So this software then, it's installed on Lenovo laptops, which are they Windows laptops?
Yes, and not all Lenovo Windows laptops as well. More their sort of consumer models. The ones that are targeted at businesses don't have it installed.
So when you install Linux on the top of your new Lenovo machine, that solves the problem, right?
Oh, completely, yeah.
Fine.
And it actually gets even worse than this, right? Because you think this is pretty bad. It's intercepting all web traffic. And the way it's doing that is by installing a root certificate in the web browser. However, these web browser certificate had the private keys on the laptop to allow it to create these certificates on the fly. These weren't randomly generated. This was the same private keys stored on every laptop. Obviously, someone broke it within a few hours of it being announced. That now means that anyone can intercept traffic from a Windows Lenovo laptop.
That is criminally negligent, I would say.
It is, and I think it points to the larger picture, because this is basically what David Cameron wants to do. And this really highlights how stupid an idea it is.
Did they say why? Is it to do with advertising, or is it to do with catching paedophiles?
It's to do with advertising. Yeah, it's a revenue stream.
It's an enhanced product consumer experience. Lenovo did use these words. They bundle all this crapware with the laptop because...
From the really Ministry of Love.
You really want to hover your mouse over every single image and link and have 50 different suggestions come up to you. We know the reason this happens. The makers of this crapware pay the laptop manufacturers to ship the software, so that supposedly makes the laptop slightly cheaper. Lenovo has said they're going to stop bundling Superfish with their
machines. Is it with a PH?
No. But apparently they haven't taken the machines off the shelves that have got Superfish on them. So in some places, at least in the States, if you go out and buy a Lenovo laptop, you are still going to have Superfish running when you take it out of the box.
I mean, it is important because many people still use Lenovo laptops as ideal Linux computers, and their ThinkPads were for many years like a default, especially for like Red Hat employees. But if you ever kept Windows installed on there, then, you know, God.
Well, this is the thing. It apparently doesn't affect the ThinkPad line because that's more business oriented. But the bigger question is, if Lenovo's going to pull stunts like this, what can you trust them with? What have they got running in the BIOS? What else is running that we don't know about?
I mean, that's the thing. This is what we've found.
Yeah.
What haven't we found?
Yeah, this has taken a few months for some geeks to actually work out what's going on here. So.
Right, let's try and get back to some more Linux-related news and some happier news as well. That's some sad news to start with.
those are the categories this episode, aren't they? Sad and happy.
I'm just scanning through. Actually, yeah, I think it is mostly happy news now.
Oh,
yeah,
that's good. Like Margaret Thatcher in the 80s wanting to end the news on a happy note.
Exactly. So no more milk for school children. But on the plus side, there's now over 1,000 games for Linux on Steam. And Valve have confirmed some AAA titles are coming. Batman Arkham Knight and Shadow of Mordor. None of that really means anything to me, but apparently it's good.
It's huge, and we'd never have believed we'd get to this place just a couple of years ago, and yet I'm still left kind of wondering, how is it going to work? I mean, there's still only 1% users of Steam are using Linux, so despite the incredible growth of titles on Linux, nobody really to speak of in the gaming community has moved to a Linux platform.
That's true, but this is all in preparation for Steam boxes.
Yeah. And so Valve has been showing off Steam boxes, and I'm really excited about it, and they obviously need to get their developers on board. And I've heard it discussed in the forums that possibly Valve's offering incentives for developers to create Linux versions, and that's the reason, rather than anything else, why so many developers are producing Linux versions.
That's possibly true, and I think there is a sort of chicken and egg situation here that... a couple of years ago, it was actually quite a lot of work to develop a Linux version. But actually, once all the sort of the background machinery has been ported, once the engines support it better, once you've actually done a few ports and you know what you're doing, it becomes so much easier.
Yeah, and I suppose gets it when you're creating your next title, you do it, you know, truly cross-platform.
Exactly, yeah, from the beginning. Yeah, I think you're right that this is all about Steam boxes, and it'll be interesting to see how those perform, because 1,000 games to have on a console at launch is pretty big.
Yeah, yeah. And the portability of it and all the other advantages that you get with Steam as well.
Yeah.
I am really excited. I mean, it's a year late now, but it's still brilliant. It's still a brilliant development for Linux.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Half-Life 3 for Linux, that's what we need. And they also, Valve at CES, they showed off in their virtual reality goggles with HTC. So yeah, that's going to be another option. I assume they'll work natively with Linux. So Linux will have two virtual reality headsets to choose between, with the Oculus Rift coming with a Linux SDK as well as Valve's. So we never need to go outside again.
But only with the Oculus Rift one will we be able to like all your friends' photos.
We just need Elite Dangerous ported to Linux.
Actually, more Valve news, because they've been talking about Vulkan and GL Next.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which looks interesting in a way I don't really understand. But it's about running far more graphics-y code and non-graphics-y code as well on your graphics card in a sort of more standardized manner. Which is still early days for now, but
they're totally open sourcing it, aren't they?
Yeah, well, it's all the GL stuff's always been fairly open, but that should definitely things definitely looking up for gaming on Linux. So next up, more happy news. Post. That's the Parliamentary Office for Science and Technology, says blocking Tor is well-intentioned, in quotation marks, but technologically infeasible. The Post don't have any actual power, but they're the people who are supposed to provide unbiased advice to MPs and Parliament in general.
For them to ignore.
Possibly for them to ignore. Parliament does like to ignore its parliamentary officers.
Or sack the advisers when they give the wrong advice. Like the drugs fella.
Yeah, like the drugs fella.
Let's pay an expert to tell us what to do. Oh no, you're sacked.
That's not what we agreed informally down the pub over a cheese sandwich. Where's Jeremy Clarkson?
Jeremy Clarkson shuns your cheese sandwich.
Couldn't this just mean that basically the government's cracked Tor and they still want everybody to keep using it so they can watch them now?
I think it's important to realise that the government do actually use Tor quite a bit, or at least the civil service does in various ways. It's quite important to the way people like GCHQ operate, and also the... Oh, I forget what they're called. The government's organisation for blocking paedophile websites. Because they need... It's absolutely crucial to them, because they can't create that... Can you still hear me?
Yes.
Ah, you're all just sitting very still. Like it had crashed.
This is what we go like when we can't hear you.
Because you can't just create, say, a GCHQ VPN and route all your traffic to that and think it's anonymized. Any anonymizing service that's only used by one sector of the population is not anonymizing. So if GCHQ used this proxy, everyone would know that proxy is for GCHQ. We know there's spies in it. But if they use Tor, then they just blend in with all the other traffic. So you need something that's used by a wide sector of the population to provide anonymization. And that's true of the very nature of IP traffic. It would be impossible to work around that in any way. And it's the same one for the organization that tracks down paedophile websites, because it's relatively simple to produce a web server that produces an entirely different website depending on what IP address you're coming from. And that's exactly what was happening. It's the Internet Watch Foundation. So you'd have a website that if you came from an IP address that was registered to the Internet Watch Foundation, you would see happy puppies playing around in the snow. If you came from another IP address, you'd see a much less savoury website. So they needed some way of bypassing this, and Tor, for that, produced the perfect solution. So, you know, Tor is absolutely essential to the function of the UK government, and it's not something that should be blocked for many reasons, but that's one of them.
It seems we haven't heard anything of David Cameron's master plan since it was announced. Has he just realised that it's silly and is therefore not talking about it anymore?
I couldn't possibly speak on his behalf, but it's possibly that. It's possibly that he's just spouting all sorts of nonsense at the moment because it's election time.
We'll see what he really thinks in those televised debates.
Right, back to the list of news to see what's next. Ooh, more happy news. Dell launches Ubuntu-loaded machines across 500 stores in Colombia, Ecuador and Peru. This supplements their retail efforts in China, India and Southeast Asia. So basically, yeah, there's an ever-growing list of countries where you can walk into a shop on the high street and buy a Linux computer.
Are those countries perhaps the highest proportion of pirated Windows versions of countries, or is that just a coincidence?
There's probably an element of truth to that, but as we mentioned with Superfish, it's not necessarily cheaper to put Linux on a machine than put Windows on a machine. Yeah. I don't know if that's true in all countries. It's certainly true in the UK, but in poorer countries, it might be that the spyware they put on gets less valuable information. They can't steal as many credit card numbers using Superfish in Colombia as they can in the UK. I don't know.
We are becoming the Top Gear of podcasts.
Fortunately, we do this over Hangouts, so we can't punch.
Where's my steak, damn it? But do I have to be the Clarkson one?
Well, didn't somebody say ages ago that you were the James May of the podcast?
You do have the shirts for it.
Thanks.
I said that because you're the producer.
Oh, yeah. So that's great. That's more awesome news. And
yeah. I don't know how this fits with, was it 20 million computers they were claiming they would sell a year?
Yes, I think that sounds...
$1 billion.
Yeah. I don't know if that means they are making their $1 billion, but best of luck to them. And more Ubuntu news up next. Ubuntu, as of Monday, Ubuntu has switched to systemd by default, at least in 15.04, the as-yet-unreleased development version. And I haven't tried this out yet, but I did put out a message on Twitter asking for anyone who's tried it and what's happened. And I had responses from Lewis Wackham. I apologise if I've pronounced that incorrectly. And Glenn Holmer saying that it's no problems. It's all gone smoothly. So that sounds like good news.
Yeah, I guess this was inevitable after Debian announced they were going to make the switch. Yeah, I mean, there is plenty of arguments for and against systemd, but it's certainly a reasonably mature piece of software now. You know, some people had beef about it a couple of years ago, saying it's too soon for anything to make a switch. But yeah, I think, you know, it's running in Red Hat Enterprise, Linux. Arch users seem to get on with it pretty well. So I don't expect there to be any major problems from here onwards.
Well, I was expecting there to be quite a few problems just in the transition, because that sounds like it's going to be painful, just apt get install a new init system. But apparently it goes quite smoothly. Yeah.
It took me about 2 days to recover when Arch did it, but that's because I didn't read the wiki.
Isn't that a crime in the Arch world, Graham? Should you not be banned from using Arch after that?
I think it felt like I was at the time because I mentioned it on the podcast and I got quite a few emails from angry Arch users to say, you moron.
Maybe when you do a Pac-Man SSYU, it should just pop up a little thing where you have to enter a code, and that code's put on the wiki.
Yeah.
It was bad at the time, I remember, because it just messed up everything, as you could imagine. Grub, yeah. Everything. There was nothing left.
And our final piece of news this fortnight is that no reboot patching is coming to the Linux kernel in version 4.
Hasn't this been promised before?
Well, it's been in the works for a long time. Because obviously Oracle have their version that they've been shipping with Red Hat Linux Oracle version for a few years. And Red Hat and SUSE have been separately working on versions. And this is sort of the mash together of SUSE and Red Hat's efforts.
Right.
And this is the first... Yeah, I mean, it's been talked about for a long time, and it's been known to be technically possible for a long time.
Yeah, I was reading up on this, and it seems like this will be usable and useful in cases where you have small security fixes. Anything that drastically changes the kernel, like changes data structures inside or the way processes are managed and stuff, you will still need to reboot. It can't fix everything like that. But if you've got a mission-critical server running, a security hole is discovered, you should just be able to patch just that without rebooting.
But presumably that will mean people running things like CentOS and Red Hat Enterprise Linux that don't change their kernel significantly. You should just be able to keep running it for the lifetime of the OS, 10 years or whatever it is.
Yeah, presumably. I think things like, you know, RHEL, Red Hat Enterprise Linux, they have point releases where they do like backport some features and functionality. But yeah, this does certainly mean those long-term supported distros. I mean, you know, the subreddit you discovered the other day, Ben, was it uptime porn?
Yes.
Yeah, that's going to be really, really interesting now when people are going to have much longer uptime.
Well, in about 3 years.
Yeah. there was something on that. I think it was like a Novell NetWare box or something, or a Cisco device that had an uptime of 15 years. That's impressive.
Yeah, and that's the news.
Epic news, Ben. Thank you. Let's move to finds of the 3 weeks. There should be a word for 3 weeks.
Fortnite.
Yeah. What would Tolkien do? Throatnight, son of Fortnite.
Does anyone want to go first?
I go first.
Of course.
So, in LibreOffice, when you're doing a spreadsheet of many tedious bits of information when you're doing the company VAT return, if you make columns narrow, it doesn't just hide a couple of digits, it rounds numbers off. So £14.98, a transaction of £14.98 is obviously two people buying, or rather one person buying two back issues. But if you make the columns a little bit narrower than that, it just becomes £15. And then you look at it thinking, what on earth could that possibly be? I've got no idea. So in trying to be helpful, LibreOffice has actually just twisted my brain around and made me look at things a lot harder than I would have done otherwise.
Does that mean we should perhaps set our prices to be like a unique hash value so that, to make it easier to work out who's bought what?
Well, they kind of are unique, almost to a point. There's only a bit of ambiguity where it could be one thing or it could be another. But I thought, what a silly thing to implement. Why?
Yeah.
You know, the whole value doesn't fit into the text area, so just change the value.
Yeah, it's a bit like you make the font smaller in a text document, and it changes the meaning of some words to match.
Yeah.
Which might be an interesting patch. I might try and write that.
So that's my find, and it's also my discovery.
Anyone else? Well, I have got a couple from the IRC channel. Ianom says his find is it's like a speed test for your broadband connection, but I've actually tried it. It's called Netalyzer. NETALYZR. The URL is netalyzer.icsiberkeley.edu. And it's just an incredibly comprehensive, far too comprehensive for most people, but probably we'd all enjoy it, comprehensive overview of your internet connection, not just your up and down speed and your latency, but all kinds of things like the ports that are accessible, the routes that go through the local DNS, what sites are and aren't blocked, what kind of worrying IP readjustment is being done on your behalf by your ISP. And it is really good. So it's a good thing to run on your internet connection.
But does this, because a couple of years ago, some of the broadband companies got in trouble for just speeding up your connection when you connected to a broadband test site.
I think, that could be gamed, yeah. But I think the main point of this is it's not so much the speed as all the other information it gives you about your connection.
Yeah.
I suppose you could do it if you had a remote server somewhere and you wanted to do it yourself, but this saves you the trouble.
Yeah. Just say lol Cameron when you log onto it from a UK site.
Another one from Devilman is cron.schlitt.info, which he says is useful for constructing bizarre cron tab schedules. I haven't tried, but I mean, cron tab is a very weird thing anyway. It's a whole word of, it must be written in Perl or something.
It really is such a... I mean, it's so useful, but it's so archaic. Because systemd replaces it, doesn't it?
It does. Systemd has timers and things, yeah.
Yeah, which... I'm so looking forward to not having to deal with...
When I look at cron tabs, actually, they remind me of punch cards. I wonder if that's what it's muddled on. You know, like stars and weird digits, like, meh.
It's one of those things I don't use often enough to remember it all.
Yeah.
So every time I do look at it, I have to rework out how it all works again.
I'm like that with a lot of Linux, to be honest. It's why I love man pages with examples at the bottom, because that's all I need to know.
Yeah,
I get the same thing. Is it CPIO, that file format? It's like once a year I need to extract something. I think RPM saw CPIO, and I can never remember the flags, and they're weird, and it's into the man page we go.
Oh, I'd forgotten about CPIOs from creating DVDs.
And Still Void says Cyanogen mod is really good. I should challenge myself. I know we don't have a challenge section anymore, but I'm going to challenge myself for the next podcast because it might make me do it to put Cyanogen mod. I think that there's now lollipop version of Cyanogen mod. So
on your Nexus 5.
Yeah. I've been using Cyanogen mod on my tablet for years, and it's I've never felt the need to switch back to Android. I did, however, I recently cracked and I installed the Amazon App Store.
Yeah. But that's it's more the Google part, the Google services thing that runs in the background. And when you're checking out battery life, you just wonder, what is it doing? Yeah. My phone's hot, you know, when it's in my pocket or something. What is it doing? I don't know. I haven't got much of a find, unfortunately, but there's a brand new release of a configuration module in KDE Plasma 5, Frameworks 5, and it's a configuration module for systemd, which is the first I've seen, or at least the first I've used, which is still quite complex, but it allows you to edit all the configuration files and quickly look at the logs and see what's running and what services are running, and change things and for different users as well, which makes it much more... I think for the majority of people, they're much more easy to understand. I wish there was the same kind of thing for UEFI booting and stuff like that, because it demystifies them.
That's really interesting. I know that there was a now abandoned GNOME or GTK front end to systemd, but I wasn't aware that there were any other GUI, any GUI work going on. So, yeah, kudos to KDE.
Yeah, yeah. Anyone else?
I've got a find that was sent in to me. So again, I haven't had to do much work in the last 3 weeks, thanks to Mr. Bruce Wolf. He says, recently I used Find to move all of my digital camera photos into a single folder, only to realize shortly thereafter that the photos I initially took with the camera were not unique. The camera had a setting that resets the counter, used as part of the file name, whenever all the files were transferred off the SD card. I updated the setting after the first month of owning the camera, but I transferred files at least 5 times during that time, which meant there was a significant replication of file names with the numbers 1 to 280. This had me in a mild panic because the last time I tried to undelete files stored on an EXT file system, I got a very large number of files recovered with gibberish file names that took me ages to filter through and sort out what I wanted. However, a quick duck-duck-go later and I found extundelete.sourceforge.net, which promised to try and restore files, including proper file names and folders, and it mostly worked. Even better, if you know the file name or directory that you deleted, then you can specifically request to undelete just those files, which again, in my limited testing, appears to work as advertised. That's pretty cool. I don't think I've ever used an undelete tool apart from playing around to see if they work. Has anybody actually had to use one in anger?
I have. I've used, I think it's called Photo Rec.
Yeah, it's part of DD Rescue, isn't it?
Yeah. And that, it worked well. I think it might have done the gibberish file name thing. I'm trying to remember.
Yeah, because all it's doing is looking at the raw blocks of data on the drive and recognizing the data as an image or whatever files it supports. So it has no index.
Yeah.
And the problem with Photo Rec as well, as I found, is if it's as soon as a file changes, if it's not in contiguous blocks, then you just get the chunk of that file, which is okay for small files like photos, but if you have any movies, for example, then you'll only have a certain number of them, a certain part of it, which you can piece them together because it'll recognize the other blocks elsewhere as well. I've had to do the same thing. I think it was I changed the partition table on something and couldn't restore the partition table with there's a really great tool that will restore partition tables. Rescue Disk, I think. But that didn't work, so I had to go through it. And it was for photos, because it's always sentimental things, isn't it? So, yeah. But now I've never looked at them. I've just got a huge folder of, like, 50,000 photos in randomly called things.
PhotoRec does do far more than just photos. It has a whole bundle of file types. But, yeah, it does give them random names.
Yeah, so that's my find, a.k.a. Bruce's find.
Great find, Mike.
I guess it's my turn then.
Yeah?
I've gone and bought a Chromebook.
Wow, what, the new Pixel?
No, not the new Pixel.
Not an RSL either.
It's a Lenovo one, because I wanted all my web traffic decrypted. It's a Lenovo N20, which is, I think a lot of sort of lower-end Chromebooks have more or less identical specs. It's a fairly low-end Intel processor, 4 gig of RAM, a tiny little thing, 11-inch screen. But I guess my real find is the Crouton, which is installs a Linux distribution in a Chroot. So you basically you boot into Chrome OS as normal, and then you launch another command, or run a command, which launches another userland on top of the same kernel, because obviously Chrome OS is built on Linux. So you end up with a new X Windows session and with a different desktop manager and all that sort of thing. So I've got LXD installed, and it just boots up and works like a normal Ubuntu distribution in this case. But it can work with Debian as well. And it actually works really well. So if I just want to do web browsing, I just quickly open it up and I get a Chrome session there in a few seconds. And if I want to do anything a bit more, or if I don't want to use Chrome, I just launch this Chroot and I've got a full Linux desktop.
I wonder if that could change soon, because wasn't another news item we didn't mention that Chrome OS is going to move to a different display server?
Yeah, I don't know this for sure, but it shouldn't affect it because it does launch its own X session as well.
Okay.
So is it using Chrome OS's kernel? Is it like OpenVZ in a container or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a Chroot, so it's pretty similar to a container.
Right.
Yeah, so it's an entirely separate userland.
How much storage has the laptop got?
It's got 16 gigs, so not that much, but enough for basic stuff. And it's got USB 3 ports, so any sort of media can just be stored and external.
How many USB 3 ports does it have?
Just the one.
Oh, like the new MacBook. MacBook. <Yeah.
laughs> It's got one USB 3 and one USB 2.
Oh, well, that's all right then. So what did you get it for then? Are you going to do a bit of like light coding on, or is it mainly writing? Or
I do most of my work on my desktop, which I have in my office, and that is a sort of reasonably powerful desktop machine that's there. But I also have a laptop which I use when I'm at home, mostly for web browsing and just sort of little bits and pieces that I need to do here and there. But it's an old thing. It's about 8 years old. It runs at about 200 degrees. It sort of glows red at night, and I'm convinced it's about to burst into flames. I think the hard drive's about to die. It's so hot when it runs. So I thought, rather than waiting till it explodes on my lap, I'll get a new laptop now. And I went for this because I don't need anything high power. I just wanted something, you know, small, portable. It claims it gets about 8 hours battery life, and I can believe that. It will obviously depend on what you do. So that's quite nice, just to not have to worry about plugging it in for a full day's work. Yeah.
The Chromebooks I've used have been really impressive. I really like them.
Yeah, it's got a full-size keyboard in that the keys are full-size, but it obviously has like the special keys, like the home, delete, all that sort of stuff. So it doesn't have those. And actually, the only thing I miss on it is the delete key. It's got a backspace, but no delete.
Right.
And I never realised I used delete a lot. I always assumed I always use backspace, but actually I keep getting annoyed that it doesn't have a delete key.
Yeah, I can't remember, but on the Mac, I've got it hardwired into my brain, the shortcut for it. So you can kind of reprogram your brain.
Yeah. I don't know if I can remap one of the other keys, because there's a lock screen key that I'm never going to use, because I'd just close the lid if I wanted to lock the screen.
Yeah.
So maybe I can remap that to delete. It's in the right space as well. What was I going to say as well? I'm away for a few weeks. One of the challenges I've set myself when I get back is to recreate all the Google services. So like the Google Docs, the Google Play Music, all those on a Raspberry Pi running from home. So I can, even though I've got a Chromebook and I run everything in a web session, I'll be actually running it on my own hardware and not using Google's back-end services. I don't know how well it's going to go yet, because I'm not sure how easy it is to recreate Google Music particularly. But I'm going to give it a go, and I'll see what happens.
You mean replacing it with different services, or making your Chromebook think that it's talking to Google Play?
Not making it think it's talking
so
to Google.
Using OwnCloud or something like that?
Well, I'll have a look at what various software's available and see what I can build together.
That sounds like a great idea for a tutorial. And they were our finds. Thanks, Ben.
That brings us reeling and punch drunk towards our halfway reminder. Still to come with Neurons and the voice of the masses. Mike, Neurons, over to you.
So, what have we got this episode? We have two neurons. The first is from XAN or Shan or Xan or however you pronounce it. He says, in your discussion in the last podcast about open source software financing, you wished there were a foundation which you could donate £10 a month to, and that would then redistribute this money according to your wishes, semi-automatically. This made me think of Flatter, which is a micro-payment provider that does pretty much that. You choose a monthly amount of money, you click a button each time you'd like to donate money to someone, and the fixed monthly budget is divided between the content providers. It's not exactly what you wanted, and it's not limited to free and open source software, but it can be a good starting point for automated donations to software projects. Flatter has an API, and you could integrate it into Apt, you know, the Debian tool.
Mm.
Only for this to be a viable financing system, Flatter needs more users on both the programmers and users side. Thanks, Jan. I have seen Flatter around on various websites. There's little buttons and stuff.
A few people mentioned it, actually, in response to our discussion last time, and it does look very, very similar to what we were talking about.
It does require you to go in and click on the buttons each month, though, doesn't it?
I think From what I understand is it's like when you've got probably an add-on installed on your browser, you get the like button or the equivalent for whatever it is you're watching on YouTube or images on whatever, and you click on that like button.
You don't need an add-on. You'll see it on a lot of web pages, just a little Flatter button.
Right, okay.
And you can go in and click on that So when basically the idea is when you're web browsing and you come across a page you like, you hit flatter, and it divides it against all the people you flattered that month. Which there is certain similarities, definitely, but it's, what I would like is something a bit more automatic for.
Yeah.
Distributing
the also money. I imagine the people that they donate to then need to get in touch with Flatter to create an account themselves.
Yeah, in this case the idea is that you can only donate to people that are set up on Flatter, yeah. I believe, and that you have to put the button on your website for people to go and click on.
And that's what we found a big challenge with our profit share bit, is they're getting in touch with people and finding ways that they can accept money, which isn't always straightforward.
Exactly. Yeah, I did for the ones we eventually included in the scheme. I did actually contact them and check beforehand that they could take money. We didn't want somebody to win, and then we realised they couldn't actually, for legal reasons, take any money from us.
Yeah.
But a solution I would like to see in this imaginary organisation is, if the organisation can't or don't want to take the money, you would have some programming resources and programmers, and you could allocate some of their time towards that project.
Yeah. That would be possible.
Or be it testers or security testers or whatever.
That's a good idea.
Moving on to neuron number two. This is from our good friend Phil the Sheep. He says, a funny thing happened to me on the way to my keyboard. I was going to my own system the other day when my girlfriend asked me if I could look at hers that had some updates she wasn't sure about. She runs Windows and unfortunately will not switch to Linux on her own system, despite my best efforts and the fact that she happily uses Linux on my laptop when she steals it to play World of Warcraft. So I duly checked and started it updating. About an hour or so later, and three system restarts later, the wretched thing had finally finished updating, or so I thought. I then got a bunch of applications notifying me that they also needed updates, so there was still more work to do. I then went on to my own system, Linux system, and the update manager dutifully popped up to tell me there were a whole bunch of updates, which it neatly and quietly did in a few minutes while I carried on using the system uninterrupted. As you know, it had not only installed system updates without needing to restart, as there were no core kernel updates, but it also updated most of the applications that I'd installed from the repositories. So next time you're updating your system, spend a moment to appreciate how well the Linux update process works and how simple and unobtrusive it is. It's one of those things we take for granted until we're reminded of how badly it can be handled as it is on Windows. Thanks, Phil. I don't use Windows at all. I haven't used it in years, but if it's still that annoying to update on Windows, then that's very sad. I mean, I thought that was what it was like in Windows 98 and stuff, but if it really is multiple reboots and, well...
Yeah, and what I really hate about Windows is that it assumes it's the only OS, so that when you shut down your machine, and let's suggest you want to shut down just to reboot to Linux, and then you find out it's got like 34 updates to install and you can't escape it, and it just carries on grinding for hours and hours and hours, and it's like, no!
Yeah.
What the power cord's for.
yeah. But it's, you know, it's just punishing me for using Windows.
Yeah, and then you often get all these temporary files left everywhere and stuff I've heard and read about. And it does make you appreciate the seamlessness of it on Linux distributions. And then, you know, if we get kernel patching without reboot soon, then that's something else we can laugh at in the face of our poor Windows using friends. So those were the two neurons this month, which is more than we had, or this episode, which is more than we've had for a long time. If anybody else wants to send theirs in, type them into an email and send that email to mike@linuxvoice.com.
I've got something that doesn't really fit into any of our segments, so I'm just going to drop it in
my
here.
Segment is always free for new ideas, and yeah.
My mum has just started using Linux Mint. She's been using it for a little while, but one problem she's having is she's got an iPod and she wants to put podcasts on it, and she's having trouble with this, and I don't have an iPod, so I've no idea. I've never used one. So if anyone here uses an iPod with Linux Mint and has any advice for what software works well or anything like that, or if it's completely impossible pie in the sky dream, let us know in the comments. My mum will appreciate it, especially as it's almost Mother's Day.
Outsourcing, wonderful. That brings us on to Voice of the Masses. Speaking of throwing stuff out to the internet and finding out what comes back. So the Linux kernel now has its own code of conduct, which they've cunningly named the Code of Conflict, which states that if anyone feels personally abused, threatened, or otherwise uncomfortable in mailing list discussions, that is not acceptable. So what we wanted to know is this a good thing? Is it a good idea? And should it be applied to other FOSS projects? Is there too much invective on mailing lists? Should we accept that snarky remarks are inevitable when geeks are discussing technical matters? Or should we all just get a thick enough skin to deal with criticism of our work? Mike, you're rubbish. Work harder.
Well, I'm used to that for the last 10 years, yeah. So I've got the thicker skin of all.
So, yeah, that, I think that illustrates what I think, really. You should just be able to insult people and make them work harder, and that's fine.
You can tell that you've worked under Nick Veitch, can't you?
Ah, Nick, lovely Nick with his great management techniques. So, Stephen Wheeler has won the internet because his comment is the right comment. There were 12 when I collated them. There's 16 at the moment, but there really is only one winner, and that's Stephen Wheeler. It says, I think that if it wasn't an issue, the powers that be wouldn't feel the need for a code of conflict to be introduced. One person's to the point remark can be hurtful to whoever it's directed at, and it's something we should be mindful of. It's just a shame that it has to be made explicit, but if that's what it takes, then so be it. In life, as in coding, I find the golden rule to be a good place to start, which is one should treat others as one would like others to treat oneself. If you're of Christian bent, you might say, do to others what you would want them to do to you. Buddhists would formulate it as hurt not others in ways that you yourself would find hurtful. Confucianism, what do you not wish for yourself, do not do to others. And it goes on. There are various permutations of that rule. And finally, the Code of Bill and Ted says, be excellent to each other. I think that's so right. Most people were generally supportive of the need for a code of conflict, apart from three people. So if you're in the car with small children, I don't know, maybe turn the sound down or come back to this bit. Tapio Hansen says, as a Finn, I feel that usually the rest of the world seems to be whining pussies who can't handle honest feedback. Using expressions like you are an idiot who can't code or please die shouldn't be interpreted impolitely or taken personally. But since it seems that only Finnish people can handle Linus and folks, I guess that having a little bit of instructions considering feedback is useful. How can you not consider being called an idiot impolitely? Lucifer says, it sounds like bureaucracy to me. Well-intended people should regulate themselves.
He would say that.
And Burgess Meredith says, he's just dismayed by the fact that we need a code of conflict. I like Linus because he's a dick who doesn't care what people think, and he's usually right. Being that Linux is open source, maybe the overly sensitive type should just go fork themselves. So I think there is some merit to those three dissenters, I reckon.
The thing is, when it's all good and well being polite to people. I've had this experience myself. When people keep coming back and submitting nonsensical patches to a project and basically clogging up the mailing list, there's only so many times you can treat them like the special snowflake they think they are. thanks for your input. You might just want to tweak this a bit. Eventually you say to people, and I never go on Torvalds-esque rants, but I will just be like, no, you don't know what you're doing. Go away. Because it's the simplest way to do it. And I don't think there's any point in personal insults. But after you've dealt with like 10 or 20 or 30 of these things and you've tried to help, eventually say, please, just leave the list. You don't know what you're doing. That's it. So I think we've all got to be able to take that sort of criticism. If we'd write bad code, it's just bad. There's no point trying to dress it up. Say, oh, well, perhaps you can improve on this for months and months and months.
Another thing that I think is important that I'm also slightly reluctant to say is that a lot of the cleverest people and the cleverest geeks that I've met aren't terribly good at communicating. And maybe there's a connection between their ability to code and their ability to commit to projects like the Linux kernel and their inability to constructively and politely engage people in conversation. And so a code of conflict is going to be a bit of a waste of time for them, or may put them off, which I think would be a bad thing. I those things that you listed off at the beginning, Andrew, I think it's a bit of all of the above. I think some people need a thicker skin as well, but certainly the extremes of Linus's rants are unacceptable.
Well, unfortunately, the type of person who needs a code of conduct is also the person who's least likely to read and pay attention to the code of conduct.
I mean, I think Linus would actually get it. He seemed incredibly, you know, personable when we met him, but you know, some of the other people I met, they're just not going to pay any attention. They're not even going to understand that people's feelings can be hurt by some of the things that they say.
It's good to have it written down, though, because it means that if there are problems in the future, you can come back to that and say, look, you're in breach of this specific set of terms and conditions, so go away and don't come back. And it then gives you a framework in which to get rid of unpleasant people.
I think another issue as well that I've seen talked about a lot is that Linus's rants have been pretty brutal sometimes, but they're so deliberately over the top that they're not direct personal attacks of people. He just comes up with sort of comedy language about how stupid somebody is. But some people, other kernel developers, wannabe kernel developers, interpret this as, oh, that's the way to behave. I'm going to be like Linus Torvalds and then start abusing people, but without any sort of wit or without any sort of, you know, craziness, or just without being Linus Torvalds. So they're just like, hey, you suck, I hate you. But then it doesn't work. And then you've just got a load of Linus wannabes or people following like Theo Durrat in OpenBSD, who's also come up with some interesting stuff in his time.
It's difficult because it's a bit of a Jeremy Clarkson situation going on here. Jeremy Clarkson and Linus Torvalds is incredibly valuable to the community. You know, he's the linchpin that holds it all together. But, you know, sack him or move him aside because he's, you know, the kernel just isn't going to be so successful. So as the BBC, we have to tolerate his rant and do whatever we can to keep him part of the team.
I think that at a certain point, you have to acknowledge that there are people who you can't create a culture in any project that's going to please everyone. You can make everyone as polite as you like, and there'll be some people who absolutely hate it because they want to tell people they're an idiot, and they would appreciate other people telling them they're an idiot when they're doing something foolish. And at the other side, you've got people who like the sort of touchy-feely, you know, I don't know what a polite way of saying it is. Sort of being nice to everyone and sort of being very constructive all the time. And there is simply no way to bring those two sides together in a way that pleases everyone. So perhaps it is time to say that some projects have this culture that some people won't like.
Yeah.
That's life. That's just the way it is. And other cultures will have a different culture that will suit people. And rather than saying, oh, this project absolutely should include everyone, say, well, actually, there's a lot of different projects with a lot of different cultures. If you feel strongly about this, perhaps look at that project.
That's a very interesting point, the cultural side of it as well, because Leonard Buttering mentioned this to us when we talked to him, and we asked him about, you know, the amount of hatred he gets, and he just says, well, I've got a thick skin, I deal with it. But he says that some cultures, especially like in Asia, the notion of saving face is very important. So if you post your work on a public mailing list and somebody says, this is rubbish, you suck, you know, we might think, oh, well, that's a crappy answer, and then go away and redo it. But, you know, for some countries, you might look so embarrassed amongst your peers, your co-workers. It might be so damaging for your reputation and self-belief.
I guess it's not terribly professional either. I mean that's what's at the core of this. I mean, these are discussions that may happen in private. You know, the discussions that normally happen in an office or whatever, you know, between a few key individuals. But this is all done publicly, and it's what people can see, and it's what's reported on how Linux is. And that's another aspect to it.
I don't know. Isn't professionalism just a myth?
I don't think it should be.
I've worked in quite a few different offices with quite a lot of different cultures, and I've seen, you know, well-respected senior people in big businesses being so unprofessional, and I've seen, you know, communities that are complete amateurs working in things where people see that absolutely professional. And to be honest, I can't see that either one of them as being empirically proven to produce better software. It's just about what culture you prefer to work in.
And if it's down to creating better software. I imagine it's working just right exactly as it is. And in fact, this will probably impede on better software being made if people are worrying about expressing themselves or committing to something.
No, I think if you clean up the culture and make it more open to a certain number of people, then it may change, and we don't know how it will change. If you open up the Linux kernel development list to more touchy-feely people, then we don't know what will happen to the quality of the Linux code. It might get worse, it might get better.
Why can't they just fork it and make the butterfly kernel or whatever it is they want to do? And
that would be awesome.
Have tea parties and discuss the system D.
Yeah, and then every so often, butterfly kernel can commit back to the main Linux kernel tree.
Yeah, yeah. Whoever's the strongest of the team can take their offering.
I mean, it is probably true that people have been put off contributing to Linux because Linux kernel because of Linus's behavior. But I think it's also true that people have been attracted to Linux because of his behavior. And I don't think you should isolate one group and say this is the right way to behave. We should accept that people appreciate different things and deal with that, rather than saying, oh, everyone should absolutely be little huggy, touchy, feely snowflakes and talk about our feelings all night.
Or maybe you could subscribe to an alternative kernel mailing list that filters out some words, so it changes "you're an idiot" into "we don't think you've got that quite right."
Right, that brings us on to Nick's user, who isn't in the category of supportive with a caveat. He or she says that, "I think that the code of conduct will be fine as long as it is not misused in two ways. One, artificial politeness. Two, false victim scenarios when code is simply subpar. This code of conduct could be beneficial if it makes contributors' mergers stick to topic and not personal attacks. E.g., I won't accept using a global variable here due to scope issues later on, instead of, I can't believe you would be so stupid as to use a global variable." Completely agree with that.
One thing I think Linus does do is he doesn't just randomly attack people for being stupid. He attacks people when they've done something stupid and they should know better. Someone who's been a senior kernel contributor for a long time doing something they really shouldn't do perhaps deserves to have it pointed out to them in quite strong terms, whereas somebody who's just getting started doesn't. And I think that context needs to be understood.
Yes, but as we've said, it trickles down into the rest of the organisation. The culture that's set at the top means that people who might use the same language and the same sort of personal attacks when it's not warranted.
That is true.
As Les W says, a code of conflict is itself fine, but the behaviours it calls for must be demonstrated by the top management at all times, otherwise it is undermined.
But what is Linus the top management of? He's the top management of the Linux kernel, nothing else. He has nothing to do with GNOME, he has nothing to do with KDE, he has nothing to do with any other software product apart from Git and Subaqua or whatever it's called. So to say he should be responsible for the culture of all free software when he has absolutely no input on the vast, vast majority of free software is also unfair.
Well, it may be unfair, but I think there is a degree of truth to it. He certainly has an influence. People talk about him more than some random contributor to KDE.
Yeah, I mean, that is true.
I know it's not the kernel, but it is sort of a similar point in that when you look at some of the questions on the Ubuntu forums, or I don't know, I've not looked on there for a couple of years, but it was always the case that people would ask, you know, some quite silly questions that had been answered several times before, and people unfailingly would point them to where it had already been answered. So rather than just, read the manual, read the wiki, Google it, why are you wasting my time? They'd have the decency to spend, you know, 10 seconds saying, it's already been answered here.
Yeah, and
whereas
there is space for both of these.
Some distros take the opposite approach and say, read the wiki.
And that's exactly the point I'm trying to make, that people like different yes. things, and people should be able to gravitate towards a project that has a culture that they appreciate, rather than trying to make yeah. up some thing and saying all yes. cultures, all this is the right culture. Yeah. It's touchy feely. Everyone.
An arch does that on purpose. You know, that's the kind of people that Arch is for. They don't want people to make it their first Linux distribution.
But Ubuntu is far, far, far more popular than Arch, in part because of its touchy-feeliness. If you,
yeah,
if
but
you
that
were
doesn't
to
mean it's fundamentally right.
No, of course it doesn't. It's just more popular in the way that S Club 7 is more popular than Wagner. but if you were to extend that approach to the kernel, how many more developers, potential developers, could you attract? Squillions.
Arguably, the kernel is developing faster than it should, certainly at a very fast rate, about as quick as it's possible to keep up with. And to develop a large project, does it need more developers, or does it need the best few developers that there are?
Maybe it needs to attract squillions of developers into the Linux kernel mailing list, who then realize that it's not that hard, and then go off and do stuff for the desktop to try and expand the pitiful 1% desktop penetration that Linux has.
The Linux kernel mailing list, I actually haven't been on it for a long time, but it used to be just a massive, massive torrent, of which about 0.001% was people talking about anything non-technical. To say that this is the whole mailing list, as people swearing at each other, is also a complete misinformation. Yeah.
I don't know. I tried learning Python once. I got stuck at lists. I'm never going to learn any C.
So that's it.
That's it. Yeah, that is pretty much it. A range of opinions.
I feel inconclusive over this, which is a good thing, actually.
Yeah, all of the opinions are correct, which is what opinions are.
I don't want to rubber stamp and approve the code of conduct. You know, I don't want to. It's a good thing to do. It's the right thing to do. But I still think there needs to be some flexibility. And Linux geeks are the weirdest people I've met.
But there will be flexibility in the way that it's applied. Of course, some people will just have a quiet talking to, and some people will just get kicked off.
But is that not evidence that it shouldn't be written down? The fact that it has to be flexible. As soon as you write it down and say, these are the rules, and people start applying them differently, then you say, well, these are the rules. You should apply them.
I can't imagine for one second Linus accepting it. I really can't. I mean, wasn't it written by Greg Crow Hartman anyway? It's like, I mean, he's incredibly difficult. He's a great person, but difficult to talk to if you're a mortal, you know. These people are just, they don't want to waste their cycles talking to you. They've got other much more important things to worry about, you know, like System D. So I don't know. I don't think it's going to work. But if it helps people feel that, you know, people are trying to change, that this community is open to criticism and accepts that things need to change, then that's a good thing.
Well, if you have your own opinion on that and you want to join a very, very big, considering the subject matter, it's such a polite discussion forum, is our Voice of the Masses thread. Join in at linuxvoice.com, and it's there in the podcast section in the menu at the top. Or just go and have a read of it for yourself. It is good, I promise.
So that's it. That's the end of
it. That's it. That's the end of Voice of the Masses.
That's a great podcast. Yeah. So we might not be able to do one in 2 weeks because Ben's going to be away, or we could do it without Ben.
Maybe we could find a Ben replacement. Yeah.
Yeah.
We could empty chair Ben.
Just have a list of recordings of things I say quite a bit and just press.
And it'll only last 22 minutes because. Right, so we'll see you all again in whenever we next record a podcast. And thanks for listening. And bye, Linux Voice. It's awesome.
Bye bye.
Bye bye, everyone.
Bye.